Support for this week's episode of Judaism Unbound comes from the Diller Teen Tikkun Olam Awards. Applications and nominations are open now. The Diller Teen Tikkun Olam Awards honor up to 15 Jewish teens from across the United States with an award of $36,000 to recognize their impact and leadership to repair the world. Nominate a teen today, or they can apply directly by January 5th. Learn more at DillerTeenAwards.org. That's D-I-L-L-E-R TeenAwards.org. This is Judaism Unbound, episode 347, Relational Judaism. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rothberg.
And we hope now that the High Holidays, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, are in the rearview mirror, that you reflect back on them and feel like you had a positive experience, a meaningful experience of some kind. And if you didn't, the holiday of Sukkot is coming up. And as we said a few weeks ago, that may arguably be the real high holiday, especially if we can reinvent it to make it somehow more meaningful for our time. One way that we're doing that here on Judaism Unbound is that we are going to be holding a gathering on Wednesday, that's October 12th, 2022, to kind of explore and reboot a holiday that takes place once every 7 years. It's called Hakel, which basically means to gather. And at least in our lore, it was a gathering that the Jews had on the holiday of Sukkot that followed the end of the Shemitah year, that year of release that comes every 7 years. What happened at this gathering? Well, there was probably a lot of talking in the halls or in the temple courtyard or wherever. But what was happening while they were chatting was that the entire Torah was read. And we are looking to reenact this gathering, this pilgrimage, in a new digital way by having a digital reading of the entire Torah that is going to start at around 6 a.m. Eastern Time on Wednesday, October 12th, culminating at 8 p.m. Eastern Time with a gathering that we are co-sponsoring with Chazon, where we are going to spend about an hour and a half reflecting together on the next 7 years, particularly with a focus on imagining what if we use these next 6 years and then the seventh year of release oriented around the issue of the climate disaster that we're facing. So you can register for this event at bit.ly, that's bit.ly/Hakel2022, that's H-A-K-H-E-L 2022. The entire event is happening in the same Zoom room, so you can come anytime during the day for some of the reading of the entire Torah, by the way, in English. There's going to be opportunities to do our own discussion and commentary in the chat while the Torah is being read on the central Zoom screen. But whether you come for the Torah reading or not, everybody is invited to show up and to gather at 8 p.m. Eastern Time at that same Zoom room for the more organized event with Chazon, where we're going to do all this imagining and discussing and envisioning. So we really hope that you will join us for that. The other thing that we want to put on your radar is that we have launched our next round of UnYeshiva classes. There are five of them. Go to judaismunbound.com/classes to check them out and register. Over the past year, over 350 people took UnYeshiva classes. We are so excited for all of those people to be able to meet one another, to talk to us, to dream together, to start to feel more and more like an unbound Jewish community. So join us for these UnYeshiva classes and check them out. And now to today's conversation with our guest, Ron Wolfson. One way that I like to describe the Judaism Unbound podcast for folks who haven't heard about it before is that we are trying to imagine the questions that we should be asking and the ideas that should be part of a Judaism of the future, even if we can't quite describe that Judaism of the future yet. But what are the big ideas that should be central to that process? Our guest today, Ron Wolfson, wrote a book almost a decade ago now called Relational Judaism, putting the idea of relationships into the center of Jewish life. Now, that may seem kind of basic, but it wasn't then. And it still isn't now. As I said, Ron Wolfson is the author of a book called Relational Judaism, Using the Power of Relationships to Transform the Jewish Community. Ron Wolfson is the Fingerhut Professor of Education at American Jewish University, where he has been on the faculty for 46 years. He is the author of 20 books on Jewish life, including The Seven Questions You're Asked in Heaven, The Spirituality of Welcoming, and a memoir, which I should note is one of my dad's favorite books, called The Best Boy in the United States of America, a memoir of blessings and kisses. Ron Wolfson is also the president of the Dorothy and Meyer Kripke Institute. We're excited to begin our exploration of this concept of relational Judaism. So, Ron Wolfson, welcome to Judaism Unbound. It's so great to have you.
Thank you, Dan and Lex, for inviting me.
Your book, Relational Judaism, came out almost a decade ago now. And as I was preparing for this interview, I was remembering that I actually spoke to you in the preparation and the lead up to that book, which I had totally forgotten. I was a Hillel director at the time, and you were doing that research. I wanted to go back to the time that you were doing the research for that book, because I'm curious about whether you were coming into that book with a sense that something was happening that you wanted to capture. You weren't quite sure what it was. And so you talked to a lot of people and you figured something out. I'm just curious, like, when someone like you, who's a professor, comes to a project like that, how were you approaching it and what did you find in that process?
I remember that conversation with you, Dan, like yesterday. It has been 10 years.
By the way, I believe I was standing at the same treadmill desk that I'm currently standing on here recording this interview.
So in 10 years, you haven't walked any forward distance.
You've yeah, just I haven't moved.
Stayed in the same place.
Yes.
Very poetic.
I'll tell you, the book came out of the work that I did with Rabbi Larry Hoffman at Hebrew Union College. We had a 20-year project called Synagogue 2000. And then when the millennium rolled around, we called it Synagogue 3000. We gained 1,000 years in 5 minutes. Larry and I started that project in 1995 as an attempt to bring together some of the really successful congregations in the Reform and Conservative movements and help them go deeper in thinking about how congregations could transform themselves into 21st century spiritual communities. And I've always been interested in relationships. And I had been traveling around the country with the project and as a scholar in residence to hundreds of synagogues. And I would always hear a similar story from people who were new to Judaism. They'd walk into a synagogue and no one would say hello. And I thought, my goodness, if we're going to build relational communities, we ought to start by thinking about the very act of welcoming the stranger. We have a fabulous story in the Torah about welcoming the stranger. When Abraham is sitting in the entrance of his tent in the heat of the day, and three strangers walk by, and the text says, he saw these three strangers and ran to greet them. Now, if you know the sentence before Vayera begins, the portion Vayera, that's rather remarkable because in the sentence before the Parsha, the section begins, he had just circumcised himself at the age of 99. If you had circumcised yourself at the age of 99 and you were sitting in the entrance of your tent in the heat of the day and three strangers came by, you would run to greet them? I don't think so. That text is all about welcoming the stranger. So that has been an interest of mine, and I brought that to the Synagogue 2000 project. That morphed into thinking more deeply about not only the act of welcoming, but the way we build relationships with people in a sacred community. So my book was called The Spirituality of Welcoming, which was my attempt to think about welcoming ambiance, welcoming prayer, and welcoming membership. And then people began to do that work of welcoming in their congregations, mainly by some congregations putting name tags on people, many of them adding a greeter at the door. Larry and I had visited Saddleback Church, and our very first visit there, we were stuck in traffic until we saw at the entrance of the property a big sign that said, for first-time visitors, please move into the right-hand lane. It was a high-occupancy lane, a diamond lane for first-time visitors. I often said to synagogue leaders, can you imagine doing that in a congregation, a synagogue, a Jewish congregation? People would see that sign, they would say, first time this year, I'm going to get in that lane. I'm going to get to the first-time visitors lot. So we were studying welcoming, and people were adding greeters and name tags and things like that. But I knew we had to go deeper than that. And so I began to think about that more deeply and talking to people in the Jewish space who were doing what came to be known because of the book, relational engagement, including you, Dan.
I was thinking just about the story that you're talking about where Abraham runs to greet the guest and it's a story of welcoming. One of the interesting things, like I hadn't thought about it quite this way until you were telling the story, but he runs to make them a non-kosher meal.
I was going to say this, Dan, we're so in the same headspace. I had notes to myself that this was going to be my next question.
Yes. Okay, well, I mean, Lex, feel free to step in. I mean, because I might be taking it to the direction that you maybe were, maybe weren't going to take, but parenthetical, I don't believe that it's non-kosher to mix meat and milk, but that's another topic for another podcast. But so the point of my question was that Abraham, you know, runs off to make a meal that subsequently Jews regard as non-kosher. But that's really what I'm curious about in terms of relational Judaism is how, because there have been times in my life where I have been more on the train of we really have to improve the way that we treat people and that we have relationships and that we think about the experience of connecting to a Jewish organization. When my wife and I were relatively newly married and had a young child, we went to a synagogue and we're exactly that. Nobody talked to us. We left and here was exactly the family that they were saying that they wanted, two young people with a baby, right? And exactly. Nobody talked to us. As I think about it, in the same city, we ended up being really interested in a different synagogue that, true, probably did have a better culture of welcoming, but really what was grabby about it was that everybody was so into the Judaism, and it just felt compelling. It felt like the Judaism was doing the engagement job. And so I'm wondering how you think about the mix between those two.
Listen, we have a great product. Judaism is a fantastic way, a pathway, if you will, to answer the question of meaning. You know, you guys are too young to remember the movie Alfie, but there was a song in that movie called, "What's It All About, Alfie? What's It All About?" That's a search for meaning. Judaism offers a pathway to find your purpose in life. What are you supposed to do with your, I would call, God-given talents and spiritual gifts to make the world a better place than you found it? Then there's this sense of belonging, which begins with welcoming. I have yet to find a synagogue that doesn't think it's warm and welcoming. And then you get in and everyone's talking to their friends and not spending 2 minutes talking to a stranger. But creating that sense of belonging is the essence of relational Judaism. And the product, in quotes, offers a place to celebrate the many blessings in our lives. So you have meaning, purpose, belonging, and blessing. So yes, without that, you could have all the greeters in the world. You could have the most welcoming place and the best coffee. If you don't have the core in a way that's accessible to people, then all of that goes away. But my argument is it's possible to be Jewish on your own and by yourself. I'm a big fan of DIY Judaism, of do-it-yourself Judaism. But having a community of relationships means that beyond the content of what we teach and the experiences we offer, there's a group of people in that community, whether it's a synagogue or a JCC or an independent minyan or a neighborhood backyard davening experience. There's a group of people who know you, who've seen you, and have connected to you, and they're going to be there for you in good times and bad. I'll tell you one thing we've learned during the pandemic. A synagogue is not a building. A JCC is not a building. A Hillel is not a building. It's a community of relationships. And without those relationships, you don't need a building. It's irrelevant. When we couldn't go into the buildings, the institutions that focused energy on relational Judaism, they did the best during the pandemic. They had small groups of people who cared about each other. They connected to their clergy and their teachers, and they kept it going online during the pandemic. It really was the proof text for relational Judaism, this whole experience in the pandemic.
I'm really interested, I'll say a bunch of other things, but like part of the question I'm asking is like, what is relational Judaism? And really specifically, like, I sense that it is a counter to something that we would term not relational Judaism, that it is fixing. What is the before and after photo of non-relational and relational Judaism? But I want to ask it specifically not just about what synagogue communities do or even what other institutional communities do. I think, I'll be candid, synagogue folks, educators, board members, et cetera, I think they are the people out of our listeners that are most likely to have heard of you and read your work. I am really interested in what somebody who is deeply invested in Judaism, but is actually not living it out in a synagogue context, not living it out in a JCC context, not living it out in a building called Jewish X, but actually cares very deeply about weaving webs that are relational of Jews and their loved ones and Jewish adjacent folks. Like, I'm curious how this applies to them. And the other thing I wanted to say is sitting really with that Abraham story you talked about, there's a teaching I read here. So let's pretend for a second we do think that meat and dairy is prohibited. I know Dan and I both are of the school that, you know, we might have gone astray in making that interpretation, but let's say it is. If that's the case, then there's a teaching here that it is more important to go out and, you know, quote unquote, meet people where they are, which is to say these visitors that have come. That trumps food rules. That, like, you do that and you grab whatever food's nearby, and if it happens to break kosher rules, fine, do it. You could take that as a teaching here. Is it a stretch? Sure. But that is an argument that we could say here. And the other thing I'd say is that we don't talk about this all the time. There's a linguistic thing in Hebrew where the word for kosher, like that's the Hebrew word for kosher. There's not a different English word. That's with a kaf, shin, resh. But there's another word, kesher, with a kuf, and that word means relationship.
That's
it means
right.
Connection. And so there's a way in which we might try in our communities to devote some of the time we devote to, like, what's our kosher policy? What can we eat in the building? What can't we eat in the building? When can we eat it in the building? Can you bring in this on this day of the week? Are there certain areas where we can break Shabbat and certain areas where we can't? Or do we have to do this in public, this in private? Like, if we had versions of that around relationships and we actually took them as seriously and we had, you know, constitutions of such things and we held ourselves to them, that might be good. So I'm kind of curious, like, how might we think more about sort of those two different kashers, the kosher one versus the relationship one? And how might we expand this beyond just sort of synagogues, JCCs, getting themselves beyond buildings, etc.?
I actually think there's a lesson beyond the actual food itself. Abraham, when he meets the strangers, says, please do not go by without letting me serve you a morsel of bread and something to drink. And then he recruits Sarah and his servant boy to create the feast with milk and meat, under promising, over delivering. He says, I'm going to get you a piece of bread and something to drink before you go on your way. And then he goes, and he not only goes and recruits the whole team to create the feast, they are also running. The servant boy runs to get not just a calf, the best calf, the Wagyu beef from, you know, you know, the A-plus prime choice USDA certified beef that he serves the strangers. Because I think underneath the story is the importance of relationship, of welcoming every human being as someone formed in what Hebrew is called B'Tselem Elohim, in the image of God. I argue that the 20th century model of engagement with our people and most of our Jewish institutions was transactional and programmatic. Transactional meaning, I pay you dues, and you give me a health club and a swimming pool and a preschool for my kid in adjacency. In a synagogue, I pay my dues and I get a rabbi on call. I get high holiday seats. I get a Hebrew school for my kids. And then once my youngest kid is done with the bar bat mitzvah or off to college, my transaction's over. Transactional is not going to cut it. Programmatic was the idea that our institutions would fill a calendar of programs, all sorts of programs for all sorts of audiences, young people, old people, families with young kids, young professionals. We'd bring in a major speaker. We'd spend a lot of money on a lecture, or we have a concert, and people would come, but they would leave meeting nobody. There wasn't an attention to developing relational connections. That's why I talked to Dan, because when Dan was at Hillel at the University of Chicago, Hillel began a program, an effort, a strategy of getting out of the building in a completely separately branded effort to build relationships with those kids who would never walk into a Hillel house. And that work continues because it's rooted in one-on-one connections in building relationships between the representative of the institution and, more importantly, between the people themselves. There is a Hebrew word to define linguistically, Lex, what you're asking. And that's the Hebrew word bain, between. When we study the philosopher Martin Buber and his great classic work, I and Thou, he was talking about the space between me and you. In the relationship is where you find the divine. So in relational Judaism, I use this word bain as the way to explore 9 levels of relationships. This, I think, speaks to people beyond the institutional framework that you're mentioning. Bein adam la'atzmo, between me and myself. And that's that question of meaning. Bein adam la'mishpacha, between me and my family. Because there's so many different permutations of family. Bein adam la'chaveiro, between me and my friends. Bein adam la'yahadut, between me and Jewish living. So how do I actualize Jewish experiences? Bein adam la'kehila, between me and the community. How do I connect to a community, whether it's a spiritual community or the Jewish community broadly defined? Bein adam la'am, between me and the Jewish people. Bein adam la'Yisrael, between me and the state of Israel. Our name is Yisrael. The ones who wrestle with God wrestle with the state of Israel, but be in relationship with it. Bein adam la'olam, between me and the world. And finally, bein adam la'makom. Makom is the Hebrew word for place, but it's one of 100 names of God. To me, God resides in the bein, in the between. That definition, if you will, of a Judaism that's relational at its core has broad application beyond Jewish institutional life, paying attention to the relational component of what they do.
I led High Holiday Services this year at Brown and RISD's Hillel. And so you mentioned this moment in Hillel's history. And when you talked to Dan, and both Dan and I, we met through that same like Hillel ecosystem. And next week, we're speaking with Rachel Gildner, who is another person from that Hillel ecosystem. I bring this up because I had this fascinating experience this year where when I connected with Hillel to lead services, they mentioned that they were going to try something different, where we were going to do our service not at Hillel, but in one of the major campus buildings of Brown University. And so I said, like, great, let's absolutely do it. But I was also in the situation of like breaking the news to the students that I was working with. And when we first talked about it, they felt like, well, we're not going to be in like the Jewish building. Like, it's going to be, there's people that are going to feel like the real stuff is happening at Hillel and we're like a separate thing. And so we actually talked a lot about this, and I ended up making my sermons pretty intentionally meditations about how we might think differently about this. And so we're there on Rosh Hashanah. Sales Hall is a building that was donated by this guy in honor of the memory of his son who died at age 19. Here we are reading Abraham and Isaac about a father putting his son up for a sacrifice. And we're in a building that was given as a testament of love from a father to his lost son. We only get to have that particular moment of connection between this campus building donated by whatever guy in the late 1800s and a Jewish story if we're in that space. We really spent a lot of Rosh Hashanah connecting to those threads of space. And what I find is I actually don't think Sales Hall is particularly interesting. I find that when you look into the history of any space, when you think about where you are and you try to connect it to Jewish teachings or stories, there's always something. There's always something, whether it's tying it to an Abraham and Isaac story. Like, if it hadn't been a father donating to a son, it would have been some other story that connected to some other prayer in the service. But we only get at that when we stretch ourselves beyond Jewish buildings. So I'd love to hear, I know you think deeply about relationships to Makom, to this name of God, but it also means place. And I actually, there's a part of me that gets bummed when we jump to Makom meaning God, because I want us to relate to our different places. How can we continue to push ourselves and Jewish life to make connections, to make relationships, links, hyperlinks between Judaism and these other places we might not expect to find it?
I'm a big advocate for Jewish teachers, rabbis, leaders to get out of their buildings. I know rabbis who take tables at Whole Foods, teachers who set up a prayer experience in backyards, entrepreneurial rabbis who've begun independent minyanim in borrowed gymnasiums. Ikar is a good example in Los Angeles. To this day, they meet in a gym that they transform into a sacred space. There's a congregation, a Jewish congregation that shares a space with a church, and they have what I call the only transformer bima pulpit in the world, where the iconography of the pulpit changes depending on whether the Christians are in the space or the Jews are in the space.
Sounds like one of those partial pool tables, partial air hockey tables where you can flip it and have multiple games.
I like it. Exactly. So I'm all for creating sacred spaces outside of our buildings or using other buildings. Your example is a good one. It's amazing how people get attached to their sanctuaries. I have a cousin who was very upset when the Reformed Temple in Omaha, Nebraska, my hometown, decided to finally move out west to where the Jews had moved. Why was he upset? Because he remembers the sanctuary as the place where he had his bar mitzvah and he got married. So I said to him, well, what if in the new building, we put pieces of the space that you remember so fondly in the new structure so that you understand that we can make a space sacred, any space sacred. What makes it sacred are the sacred relationships and the experiences that we hold in those spaces. So I'm all for breaking out of the buildings themselves, and especially going to where people are. In Boston, a new effort is being built called Lair House, which will be a combination of a bar, tapa restaurant, and study hall. And it will be smack dab on a street corner in Cambridge, Massachusetts, to bring Judaism to where people are. We should think about the ways we can bring Jewish life to where our people live.
I'd love to go back to what you were saying about the Baines, if I'm understanding you correctly, because I think I was asking you earlier about the sort of dichotomy between the relationship-based engagement, which I might stereotype as a means to an end, as a tool, versus the content of Judaism itself, which I'm always hoping can be improved and made more gravitational. I want to check if I'm understanding your point of view correctly, which I find very interesting. And then the question becomes, where does it lead? That, no, actually, that's not a dichotomy. That the Judaism itself, the purpose of it, and we've asked on this podcast, what is Judaism for? That the purpose of it is to build these different layers of relationship, the space of the Baines, as you're saying, the betweens. And I guess I want to first check, is that right? Is that what you're saying? And if so, I guess my question is kind of, how are we doing? I mean, you say that Judaism is so great and we don't have, you know, we have an amazing product. But I question that, right? I wonder whether we have the raw material of a really great product, but somehow it's not working. And I wonder if maybe part of why it's not working is that people don't understand the point that you've made, that actually all the stuff should be in service of the relationship. And if it's not doing that, it's not an engagement problem, it is a product problem.
I think that the answer to that question is yes. I believe that Judaism is firmly rooted in relationships on these many levels. And that is what Judaism is for. Judaism is a pathway. It's not the only pathway, but it is a pathway that is rich with the understandings of why relationships are so critical in our lives, that we are in relationship with God, something beyond ourselves, some spirituality, if you want to take God out of the equation, and between each other. And this is, I think, my most important contribution to the conversation about what Judaism is for. I think it's for building a relational community that helps individuals find a pathway to those four things that I mentioned: meaning, purpose, belonging, and blessing. When I talk to people who have found those things in their lives, and they've done it within a Jewish context, and I ask them, what keeps you Jewish? Why are you still engaged in this faith tradition, this culture, this ethnicity of ours? They ultimately answer it with that it inspires me, it motivates me, it helps me figure out what this thing is all about. And not only myself personally, but for the loved ones in my circle, for my friends, and for my community. Not everybody gets there, but the more people explore Judaism, the way you guys have done so brilliantly with Judaism Unbound and the Un Yeshiva and all your other projects, you're opening up this product, in quotes, to people who otherwise don't feel a sense of welcome or access. There is, and I don't have to tell you because you've had all the leaders of the explosion of creative expression of Jewish life in the last 20, 30 years. You know, when I got out of college, we had one book that came out of the 1960s that was creative Jewish practice. It was called the Jewish Catalog. Exactly. One.
We had an episode about that. We'll feature it in the show notes on our website.
Great. One book that ended up being, by the way, the biggest selling book in next to the Torah, next to the Bible, in Jewish publishing history by Jews who are inside the Jewish space and those who we're talking to many on this podcast, the people who want to find a way in, but find the barriers to be extraordinary. I admire and I support and I applaud those people working in the Jewish space who are breaking down the barriers, welcoming people in, explaining this tradition we have in a way that makes it accessible, meaningful, joyous, fun. It's extraordinary what's going on.
There's something, though, that as you're talking, I'm hearing something that really is shifting my own understanding of, you know, maybe what Judaism is, which I'm thinking about the joke. And I don't remember the exact setup of the joke, but the punchline is, right, that Goldberg goes to synagogue to talk to God, but I go to synagogue to talk to Goldberg.
Yes. I think that's the whole thing. I think you nailed it.
No, but I think there must be a setup to it. But anyway, there's a...
That's the joke.
But I remember that I was leading a program for rabbis who were doing innovation within their synagogues. And I had the various rabbis do a little bit of conversation with the people in their communities who weren't really going to synagogue and those who were. And one of the rabbis I remember came back and he said he was like shocked by what he found because he spoke to his stalwarts, you know, the people who were coming to synagogue all the time. And he said the vast majority of them were there to speak to Goldberg.
That's right.
That threw him for a loop. And what's interesting to me, though, is the thought that he obviously was seeing that as a bug, not a feature. You know, and a little bit, I was trying to kind of push him to see that as a bit of a feature, like a good thing. But now I kind of see that it may be even more that, that the problem is that not enough people are going to talk to Goldberg. And the question is, to me, what are the capacities to make to enable that? And partly, I'm curious here, maybe where we have to learn this from is from some of the church world. But it feels to me like what I have a lot of empathy for is small staffs of synagogues or other Jewish organizations that say, how are we going to be even more relational? I mean, it's not like we're sitting around, you know, it's not like we have time. So how is it done that a community can shift its way of understanding, not only, again, not only as a technique to engage people, but as an understanding of the substance itself of what Judaism is all about, to say that it's relational and we need to put that at the center? How does that actually happen in practical terms?
A great question, Dan. I was a scholar in residence once in a synagogue. On Friday night, the Rabbi Emeritus was an old friend, and he said, you know, Saturday morning, Shabbat morning, you can sit with me if you don't want to sit on the pulpit, which I never wanted to do as a scholar in residence. I wanted to sit with the people. I said, great. So as a scholar in residence, I was always at shul at the synagogue early. And I get there at 10 minutes to 9. The service is going to start at 9 o'clock. And there are about 10, 12 people there right at 9 o'clock when the service started. So I walk into the sanctuary. It's a huge sanctuary, like it seats 700 people. So I take a seat two rows from the back of the sanctuary, thinking when the Rabbi Emeritus shows up, I'll see him come in and we can go sit together. So I sit down on the aisle seat. At about 15 minutes in, I feel a tap on my shoulder and I see a sweet gentleman and he says the following to me. You have to hear this exactly. He says, you know, I wouldn't tell you that you're sitting in my seat. I've probably heard this a million times, so I knew what was coming, but I didn't know that this was coming. He points to the last row in the sanctuary, which was empty. And he says, I would sit in that seat, but if I sat there, where would my friend who always sits there sit? Now, I look around the sanctuary. There are 685 empty seats. But this man needed that seat. Speaking of the word makom, it's called makom kavua, your established place in the community. He needed to sit in that seat. And I knew this man. I did not know him personally, but I knew the type. So what do you think I did? I went and found another seat. And then I thought about it. If I was a stranger, a first timer, a shul shopper, and that had happened to me, that synagogue is off my list. But then I thought deeper about it. To your point, Dan, he's right. If his friend is not in his usual makom kavua, his usual seat, he's going to worry about him. That's the essence of a relational community. You know, my friend and colleague, beloved friend and colleague, Harlene Appelman, just passed away a few weeks ago. She was the executive director of the Covenant Foundation, but her early work was with the Wizen Institute for Jewish Family Life that I ran. And Arlene liked to say all the time, she would quote, people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And that too is part of what's underneath this idea of relational Judaism. I told this story about getting kicked out of a seat once to the board of my own synagogue that I attend, Valley Beth Shalom in Encino. And a guy named Murray Geller, may he rest in peace, raised his hand and he said, you know, Ron, that happened to us. We had our makom kavua, our regular seats, in the fifth row. One Shabbat, we ended up coming late. And we get to the synagogue, and sure enough, there are two strangers sitting in our seats. And I said, "What'd you do, Murray?" He said, "Well, the first thing we said," and I often tell this story and ask leaders of synagogues, "What would you have said?" And Murray said, "The first thing we said to these strangers is, Shabbat Shalom." And then they asked the best question to these strangers. Murray asked them, "May we sit with you?" The two strangers moved over two seats so Murray and Rose Geller could get their regular seats. But the story doesn't end there. During the Hakafah, the parade of the Torah scroll through the congregation, they started to talk to the strangers. Murray and Rose invited this couple to sit with them at the Kiddush lunch. Fast forward 20 years, I was giving a lecture in Toronto, and I told this story. And from the back of the room, shoot up hands, two people yelled, "That was us!" They became close friends. They had been at each other's kids' weddings. That's the difference between teaching a congregation of any kind how to be truly welcoming beyond greeters by every person understanding that he or she or they are a representative of the congregation. It was the people in the community who had learned the value of relationship building.
Right. And what I want to say, I mean, I'm glad you brought up that last piece, because I'll be honest with you. I mean, it's always a risky thing to say. You told a beautiful story, and I don't want to deny on any level. That's a beautiful story. And I love what you describe with the Gellers and their new friends. It was also, it was luck, because if the people who showed up early sat in some other row, by the sound of it, I don't know these folks, but like, it sounds like the reason that they sort of proposed, "Hey, we should sit together," was because they wanted to sit in their normal spots, and that's where they were. And so what I actually want to push people to think about, if they are regulars at a synagogue community, and a lot of our listeners are not, but if they are, have your makom kavua, sure, have your seat, but I think we got to really seriously rethink if on any level we are sort of entitled to that real estate by virtue of being a regular. I think we need to unlearn all the ways in which we've taught ourselves that communities are made up of people that have like more and less stock. And I'm using like economic language because I actually think it often is economic. I think it's often people. So it's either economic in the sense of monetary contribution, the people who give lots of money to the community, get the seats they want, et cetera. But it's also the people who give the most time. I don't know if they teach themselves this or if the community teaches them this, but they believe that what they think is more important to the functioning of that community than what people think who might also be members, but don't come there as much, or especially people who aren't yet members. And what I would say is we should have a norm where if somebody new is in the sanctuary, one of the regulars, or even one of the semi-regulars, goes and hangs out with them, even if it's the opposite side of the sanctuary from where they normally sit. And what I want to ask is actually not about sanctuaries and seating. I think all of that is harder automatically, to go back to the stuff I said before, in the building. And I want to talk, because of the time of year we're in, about Sukkot. So as we release this episode, Yom Kippur has just happened. Sukkot is coming up. I think Sukkot, from a relational Judaism standpoint, is just built better than Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah, at least as it has been built and as we have inherited it. Nobody has their quote-unquote my seat in the sukkah. You're only there 1 week out of the year. By definition, you can't have a seat that is yours such that somebody else sitting there is going to bother you. And also, the norm of sukkahs is people have them in their backyard. You invite random strangers to come. You invite mythical ancestors to come. You invite That's everybody right. to come. That's Literally right. living and dead. There is no line. And if people are randomly passing by on the street and they see your funny Jewish hut and they ask, "What is that?" You welcome them in. And I actually don't think that's rare. I think most people would do that including people who, if they go to synagogue, have that third row, fourth seat from the left that they must sit in. Given that we have this holiday Sukkot that embodies everything we're talking about, it doesn't take place in the synagogue building, but it's not a bunch of words, it's not a bunch of liturgy. It's you go, you hang out with your friends, and that's Sukkot. You're outside, it's either nice weather or it's raining. You know, there's pluses and minuses to both of those, by the way. If it's raining, you get a story to tell. We have this opportunity. We have an existing holiday that pushes us outside of our buildings where people don't even realize there is a synagogue component and where we are called to interact specifically with all sorts of folks we don't know, living and dead. And so I'm curious if you have strategies or tips or ideas that you would advise us to lean into as we prep for Sukkot.
Sukkot is the ultimate relational holiday. It does push us out of our buildings. We create a temporary structure. And that structure, by definition, according to Jewish law, must have an opening, a big opening. There's only three walls. One wall is completely open, a great metaphor for relational engagement. Our little makom for this 8 days is wide open. Not only that, it's true that a sanctuary, a Jewish sanctuary, has to have a window in it so you can see out, according to Jewish law. But the sukkah has a temporary roof that you must be able to see through. Again, open. And yes, we invite mystical strangers, our ancestors, night by night, a great metaphor for bringing guests into the sukkah. So many schools have a sukkah a parade through a neighborhood where people go sukkah to sukkah for a progressive meal. That in each sukkah, you meet some new family, which is also a relational engagement strategy. And everyone loves to invite a guest to the sukkah because it's such an extraordinary, wonderful experience. And it's one of the things I'm thrilled about. Sukkot building now has become a thing. The creativity in building and decorating a sukkah has been remarkable. And the second example, of course, is Passover Seder and the revolution of resources to bring to the Passover Seder. And there too, when I was a kid growing up in Omaha, even though my Bubby and Zadie, my grandmother and grandfather, had 35 members of our extended family and guests to a big crowded table in the living room and dining room, they always sat an empty chair for Elijah. It's kind of a tradition that's fallen out somewhat. We have Elijah's cup at the Seder table, but to have an empty chair at the table, even on those crowded Passover evenings, is a metaphor for the same thing we've been talking about throughout this podcast. There should always be an empty chair at the table at your Shabbat Kiddush. There should always be an empty chair in your sukkah for the guest. There should always be people who understand that welcoming the stranger, we're taught in the Talmud, is more important than welcoming the Shekhinah, God's presence. You can't get a deeper Jewish value than that. And that welcoming is just the beginning of building a relational community.
It's funny, just as you were talking, I got a text from my daughter, who is a high school student, but she happens to be walking through the nearby university campus. And it's a really excited text that says, Chabad is out here giving out cotton candy. And I don't know, there's just something there. But, you know, if you have something to say about Chabad, I would be interested in it too. But I'm curious about just our last, the last few minutes that we have. I know that you and I are both, have both been really interested and have had, spent some real time studying the local evangelical megachurches in our areas. You, Saddleback, and for me, it's Willow Creek Community Church outside of Chicago. And I'm thinking about evangelical Christianity on two levels. One, that these were small startup organizations that had relational Christianity, let's call it, at their very core of their DNA from the very beginning. And they got huge because of that. And then there are all these other churches that are saying, you know, how can we learn from this? How can we try to take their approaches and bring them into our church? And I'm wondering, A, how successful that's been in the Christian world, and if there's anything that we can learn or not learn from how the Christians have succeeded or not succeeded in taking those actions into their churches. And I also wonder, just to note, that we have seen the evangelical world embracing really troubling ideas that some of the more mainstream Christian churches have not embraced. And I wonder whether there is also a danger, maybe, in not in having relational be significant, but somehow in if you fail to understand that the relationalness of it is the core of it all, if somehow even maybe, I guess I'm wondering maybe even if those churches somehow forgot and eventually got so sure that relational, they started to use relational as a tool, that they somehow lost their way a little bit on the substance itself. And I'm wondering what you think of that.
I've studied Chabad. There's a chapter in Relational Judaism on Chabad, a case study. I was invited to the Chabad Shluchim, the messengers, the emissaries conference. I am a friend of Rick Warren's, and I've been taking my students there every year for years and years now. If there are 1,000 people or more wanting to go to a religious spiritual experience, I want to know what's happening. I want to know what's the secret sauce of getting that to happen. My studies of the megachurch show me that there are several component pieces. And certainly one of them is the fact that when you become a member of Saddleback or Willow Creek, there's a process of induction into the community. And one of the things that Saddleback at least emphasizes is for people to join a small group. There are thousands of small groups that meet every week in people's homes. It's not in their building. It's in people's living rooms. By the way, the Mormons do this too. Rick Warren, if you asked him, what's the secret sauce of the success of Saddleback Church, will tell you it's because of our emphasis on small groups. That's why, with my two colleagues, Rabbi Nicole Auerbach and Rabbi Lydia Medwin, and I put out a book called The Relational Judaism Handbook that shows how to build a small groups campaign in a congregation or a JCC or other institutions. Now, Chabad understands that the beginning of their work is relational. If you meet a Chabad rabbi, within 10 minutes, you're invited to his home for a Shabbat meal or a Kiddush lunch or something. Their strategy is to bring people into Jewish practice. Yes, they'll ask you to shake a lulav. It's Sukkot coming up. And I've done that in the waiting lounge at American Airlines. They define the work of going to where people are to bring Judaism to the people. In Brooklyn, next week, you can find portable Sukkot on the top of pickup trucks all over the city, led by young, aspiring shluchim, Rebbe's messengers, to invite people into a sukkah in a pickup truck. They have defined bringing Jewish life into the public space. And it's about time that the liberal movements understood the power of Chabad, the biggest, most successful Jewish outreach organization in the world. I have so many disagreements with Chabad and with the megachurch evangelical community, but there are things to learn.
Thank you so much, Ron Rolfson, for joining us. This has been a fantastic conversation.
Thank you for inviting me, and Chag Sameach.
And thanks so much to all of you out there for listening. We hope you've enjoyed this conversation, and we hope that you'll tune in again in the future. Before we go, we want to remind you that in just a few days, we've got our Hakel event happening in partnership with Chazon. That is on October 12th, this coming Wednesday. And all day we will be reading the entirety of the five books of the Torah. You'll be able to come to Zoom and give your own live commentary on wherever we are in the reading. Come, say what you think, say what's bothering you, say what you love. All of that is welcome. Dan and I will be doing various shifts over the course of the day and be there giving some of our own commentaries and questions. So that'll be super fun during the day. And then a culminating event at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, once again, on the 12th, Wednesday, we're going to have a gathering. That's what Hakeel means. It means to gather together. And we're going to have a big gathering with Chazon. And we're going to be thinking about the past 7 years and starting to look forward into the next 7 years, especially as we turn the page from one Shemitah cycle to the next with this ritual of Hakeel. So we hope that you will join us. You can sign up at bit.ly/Hakeel, H-A-K-H-E-L 2022. So we hope to see you there. And now we will close out in the same way we always do, by encouraging you to be in touch with us. And there are a wide variety of ways for you to do that. First, you can head to our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram pages. All of those are at Judaism Unbound for our handles. Second, you can check out our website, judaismunbound.com. And third, you can email us, dan@judaismunbound.com or lex@judaismunbound.com or both. We love receiving emails with questions, thoughts, arguments, whatever you've got related to our podcast or our work. So we hope that you'll be in touch. And the last thing, of course, is that we deeply appreciate financial donations that you're able to give if you would like to do so. And you can do that at www.judaismunbound.com/donate on either a monthly recurring basis or just as a one-time gift. Support for this episode of Judaism Unbound comes from the Ashman Family JCC in Palo Alto, California, whose vision is to be the architects of the Jewish future. The Ashman Family JCC empowers you to experience Jewish paths toward a life of joy, purpose, and meaning through innovative Jewish learning and wellness programs, community building, and initiatives to develop the next generation of Jewish leaders. Learn more at www.paloaltojcc.org. So thank you so much for listening. And with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.